Dr. Cowan's got a new book out, and we're going to discuss that today. Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness by Dr. Tom Cowan. So, Dr. Cowan, thank you very much for joining us again today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, I'm excited to talk about this because this book really approaches things. I mean, everyone's kind of aware there's a controversy in the vaccine world, and we've had, the producer of Vaxxed, Andy Wakefield's been on the show. We've had Bill Thompson, the kind of the whistleblower of that whole controversy with the CDC. So we've talked about vaccines and kind of the pros and cons. We've had Stephanie Seneff on, giving her input on glyphosate and aluminum and mercury. But your book really takes another approach, and you're linking, you're making a linkage between this childhood disease epidemic that we're currently experiencing and autoimmunity in particular. So it's a fascinating look at this, and I encourage the listeners to get the book. But I want to start off right off the bat, just these stats. I think this in chapter one, where you talk about American kids are just sick. In the matter of just the past decade or two, not 50 years ago and 30 and 40 years ago when you and I were growing up, but today, 1 in 2.5 children has an allergy. 1 in 6 children has developmental disability. 1 in 9 children have some sort of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. 1 in 11 with asthma. 1 in 13 with severe food allergies. 1 in 36 with autism. So this is really just a staggering display of chronic illness. I think I read somewhere 50% of kids overall just in general have some sort of chronic illness. So we've got a totally different problem on our hands is one way to look at it. If you're looking at it from a vaccine standpoint, we used to worry about diphtheria and some of these infectious diseases, but now we've got to step back and look at what in the world's wrong with our kids. So kind of tell the listeners or walk through, if you can, how you came to the point of wanting to write this book, and how did you start to connect dots between the current CDC vaccine schedule and the autoimmunity and the disease in general that we see? How did you get to this conclusion and to this point of writing the book?
When I went to medical school, I was already, I would say, skeptical about a lot of things in medicine, and that led me to look into anthroposophical medicine, which is the medicine of Rudolf Steiner, and that led me also to become interested in more of the history of medicine, which I think it's very unfortunate that doctors are mostly pretty unaware of the history of medicine before about maybe 1960 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I ran across was an interesting saying by Hippocrates that said, "Give me a medicine to produce a fever and I can cure any disease." So as far as the dominant philosophy of medicine, and I would say this was not just, Hippocratic medicine, but medicine in Native American medicine, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, basically every kind of medicine before what we would call allopathic conventional medicine of the 1930s, 40s, and after that, the role of fever in preventing chronic disease, preventing things getting worse, was well recognized, and for literally thousands of years, the dominant way people looked at it. You know, I tell people, basically, if you get a splinter in your finger and you make pus, which is one manifestation of an acute illness, the pus is not the disease, it's the therapeutic attempt. And that may seem like a silly example, but people remember it. But if you think about it and you put cigarette smoke in your lungs and then twice a year you get bronchitis, similarly, the bronchitis is not the disease. It's the therapeutic attempt by the body to get rid of the smoke that you just put in. And when you have bronchitis or when you have pus, you're having an infectious acute illness, usually or often with a febrile process involved. And then in my, while I was still in medical school, when I was going to anthroposophical medical meetings, I heard about the work of a surgeon named John Coley, who was in New York City at Sloan Kettering, who was a sarcoma specialist, and he basically, he was a underling of a guy named Ewing, who a lot of doctors have heard of because Ewing sarcoma was named after him. So he was probably the foremost sarcoma specialist in the world. And so Coley was a student of his, and so, of course, when he had sarcoma patients, he treated them like he was taught. And then the story goes that he ended up having John Rockefeller's mistress, or so-called friend, as a patient with sarcoma, so he did the usual treatment. And she died about 8 weeks later, and that was pretty disgruntling for him because obviously she was kind of a star patient. He then looked into the history of this, of sarcoma at the hospital, looking through all the records, and he basically only found one person who was cured of sarcoma at their hospital. It was a dock worker named Stein, who turns out got erysipelas, which is a very bad strep infection of the skin, and had a high fever for 4 weeks, and he never ended up having an operation or any other kind of treatment, and was discharged, supposedly cured of his sarcoma. He went and found the guy, and it was like 8 years later, and said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, I got sick, and that made the sarcoma go away, and so I've been fine ever since." Coley then spent 30 years investigating the role of fever and acute disease in curing cancer. It became probably the most successful cancer therapy ever. I ended up getting a book of over thousands of cases. They recorded all the cases at this hospital that were treated with so-called Coley's toxins. I was given it by his granddaughter. And so I got interested in the whole role of fever in particular, but acute disease in the treatment and prevention of chronic disease. And I came to the conclusion after 40 years of looking into this, or a lot sooner actually, that Hippocrates was right. And that any medical system that is based on preventing children in particular, but anybody, from going through febrile illnesses is inexorably and inevitably doomed to create a whole population of chronically sick people. And essentially, modern pediatrics, I would describe it as a war on acute illness. And that's why we have what we have.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I want to dive into a little more. I want to, for the listener's sake, talk about that Coley's toxin just a little bit more. Basically, what he figured out with his strep infection, I think if I remember right from your book, he experimented a little bit on sarcoma patients at the time by giving them the strep bug, and some of them actually died. Some got better, though. And over time, he perfected that where he didn't actually give them the entire bacteria. He just gave them kind of a piece of it, enough for the immune system to mount a fever response. And over time, he perfected it more, and I think combined a few different toxins from different germs, so the patients weren't actually getting the entire illness, but it was provoking a high fever, and he'd give them a shot of this toxin every day for 30 days or something like that, so they'd have a fever every single day. And I believe your book said it was like a 60% cure rate at the peak of its success for cancer, which, of course, even by today's standards would be amazing.
The early days, you're right. He actually like had the patient with whatever stage 4 cancer, because in the beginning they, of course, only allowed him to do this with terminal cancer patients. So we're talking about people who were basically given up and had done everything that they did at the time, and it was unsuccessful. So even then, so he had him just basically lay in the bed with a person with erysipelas, and you know, approximately 40% got cured, 40% died of the erysipelas because they didn't have antibiotics, and, you know, some of them died. Mm-hmm. 20%, interestingly, never got sick, no matter what he did. So that's also an interesting comment. And as you say, later he just isolated the, you know, lipopolysaccharide, that's the, you know, fever portion of it, that stimulates the cell-mediated immune system. And so that was safer, in a sense, because nobody died, because he didn't give anybody infection.
Right.
You know, there's an interesting corollary to that story, and I believe this is the actual story, is his granddaughter married the guy who became head of Sloan Kettering Cancer Research, one of the most famous cancer research centers in the world. And so they started experimenting with what they called tumor necrosis factor, which is a chemical made in the body by, when you have bacterial infection. And so they experimented this for 20 years. You know, Coley was still considered the father of immunology. The irony of tumor necrosis factor, which was very toxic and didn't work very well, was that they would give it, and then when the patient got a fever, they would suppress the fever with, you know, Tylenol and aspirin, and then it didn't work. And so somehow they just didn't understand the concept. You can't do this without a fever. You know, you can always try to make the world to be what you want,
right?
But it turns out the world sometimes is what it is.
Yep.
So they say, well, it's uncomfortable or not fun to have a fever. Right. But if it's the fever that's the therapy, that's just the way it is.
Right. And this was actually an FDA-approved therapy, or at one point the FDA came in and did not approve it, so basically you can't get this Cooley's toxin anymore. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, it was made by Wyeth Pharmaceuticals. I have an old, you know, like bottle of it from, it was three or four competing Coley's toxins, you know, each, you know, as you can imagine, raises your temperature the highest.
Right.
So one, you get 104, and one, you get 105, and one, 103. And so it was the adjunctive cancer treatment before chemotherapy came into vogue after World War II. And it was very successful, and essentially, besides being unpleasant, you know, because you don't feel good, and the fever comes on amazingly suddenly, like literally from 1 second to the next, you're fine, and then you're shaking like a leaf. And then they banned it and put it on the unproven list, and since the, you know, with chemotherapy, ever since then you can't get it, And I think I may be the only person who actually has a copy of that book, which was the list of all the cases that
wow.
he treated at that hospital.
Wow.
Thousands of them. I mean, it was, and everyone with the outcome and side effects and everything.
Well, I'm going to read a quote here from the introduction of the book, because I think it fits right in and takes us into our next subject. But you said, one who wonders about the inherent cost of trying to prevent children from experiencing adversity of any kind. One who thinks that when we approach natural systems with brute force, trickery, and pathological need for control, we usually fail. And one who, after 33 years of medical practice, is still asking, what are we really doing to children when we vaccinate them? And you went on another quote to say, after nearly four decades as a doctor, I believe the medical profession is a party to one of the most grievous errors a nation has ever perpetrated on its own children. I believe that the chronic autoimmune conditions, including autism, are directly linked, though not limited to, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's recommended vaccination schedule that most American children follow, and I believe we are in the midst of a massive crisis that is only going to get worse if we don't change course. So those are some pretty powerful quotes, and I think before we dive into why, more of the why behind those quotes, a little bit of an explanation about the immune system, how it was intended to function, cell-mediated immune system response, and the antibody or humoral-mediated response. Let's try to put that into layman's terms a little bit so people get a sense for how the immune system should work, and then they can help. That'll help them to see this conclusion of why the immune system's so dysfunctional, because I want the listeners to know this. These autoimmune diseases, they all have different names, rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis and Crohn's disease and MS, multiple sclerosis, and all these different things. But even allergies, asthma, and autism have, we now know, are kind of an autoimmune. So they have all these different names, but really it's all the same thing. It's an immune system dysfunction. So talk to us about a normal immune response and how the body was designed to deal with germs and toxins, turn on and fight them, kill them, get rid of them. Go through cell-mediated versus humoral response, if you could.
Right. So here comes the sort of point of the book, and it's a very good introduction there. So let's take chickenpox as an example of a viral disease. So here you are, a person, let's say a child, and you've never experienced chickenpox before. So you get in contact with the virus, and the virus, because you haven't contacted it, gets in and infects many of your cells, probably thousands, maybe even more. So the body then has all these infected and dysfunctional cells, which it wants to rid itself of. So that's essentially like the splinter. And so it creates what's called a cell-mediated response, which is mediated by certain chemicals, but mostly by the white blood cells that essentially go in and digest these infected cells and then excrete them. Now, the cell-mediated response is accompanied by things like rash and fever and mucus and cough and all these things which we call sick. And I can't emphasize that enough, that what we call sick, like fever, rash, cough, not feeling well, is not actually the virus. It's the cell-mediated immune response. Now, people could say, well, how do I know that? And the reason I know that is because you could infect somebody with chickenpox and then suppress their cell-mediated response with, say, prednisone, and they will not be sick. You could kill them, but they won't be, like, sick, like a cold or a flu type sick. On the other hand, you don't need any virus or any infecting organism. You can stimulate the chemical mediators of the cell-mediated response, and the person will be sick. So that which we call sick, that's such an important point, is your body's response to needing to clear something out, in this case, a virus or a cells that are infected with the virus. Now, the next step is you don't want to have to go through this every 6 weeks every time you are exposed to somebody with chickenpox or mumps or anything. So we have a second part, a sort of memory part, which is called a humoral or antibody-mediated immune system, which takes about 6 to 8 weeks, and then you make antibodies to one of the particular parts of that virus, say, a protein on the coating. And so anytime you experience that virus or that infection again your entire life, you will remember it, and you'll make an antibodies will clear it, and you never need to get the cell-mediated immune system involved again, and therefore you will never get sick again. You will never have any other symptoms from that virus. The important point about this system, this two-part system, is it's incredibly precise and it's incredibly reliable and foolproof, to the point where I don't even know if there's a single case of a human being getting measles twice in their life. It just doesn't happen. You don't get mumps twice. You don't get chickenpox. You can get shingles, that's different. But so anytime you go through both together, you you are immune for life. And I would also say, as far as I can see, that's the only way you can get immune for life. Now, I'm still old enough to remember, I wasn't a doctor then, but at the beginning of the vaccine program in this country, we were told that immunity from vaccination was identical to to the normal natural immunity. However, even then, there was very clear reasons to think that wasn't actually true. The first reason was there's a childhood disease considered an autoimmune disease called nephrotic syndrome, where basically children's kidneys leak and eventually it could kill them, and they give them prednisone, and sometimes it goes away and sometimes it doesn't. And it was well known in many cases in the medical literature that some of the children with nephrotic syndrome who got measles, their nephrotic syndrome would go into remission and never come back. Essentially, the measles cured them of nephrotic syndrome. So, of course, since the vaccine gives the same immunity as the natural illness, they took children with nephrotic syndrome and gave them a measles vaccine, and, of course, nothing happened, nothing good or nothing bad. The second reason that should have alerted them was there was one case, which I spoke about in the book, of a child born with hereditary A-gamma globulinemia, which means they had no ability to make antibodies. This child got measles, went through cell-mediated reaction like usual, then was fine, and they said, well, this will be interesting because without antibodies, this child will get measles over and over and over again, and that's at least, you know, that'll be interesting. We can see what happens. Turns out, child never got measles again. Now, it could be that the child was never exposed to measles, but they were in the pre-vaccine era, so they were probably exposed, you know, 5-6 times a year. And so it turns out that the cell-mediated immune system is crucial to the development of immunity, even though we don't really understand why. The humoral part helps, but the cell-mediated is also crucial for permanent lifelong immunity. Now, here comes the most important point of the book, which is the whole purpose of the vaccine program, and I can't emphasize this enough, is to not create a cell-mediated reaction. Because if you gave somebody, say, a measles shot and you created a cell-mediated reaction, it turns out with measles there is a very small cell-mediated reaction, but not much. But most of them, like diphtheria toxin, there's no cell-mediated reaction. That's the whole point of the vaccine, is to bypass the cell-mediated reaction and stimulate only an antibody response. Now, the interesting thing about it is if you take diphtheria toxin and salt water and a preservative like vitamin C or BHT or something like that, the body won't make antibodies. So you have to put something in there called an adjuvant, otherwise known as a helper, that stimulates a broad-spectrum antibody reaction. You see, people are always asking me, they say, Tom, why do they put this stuff like aluminum and formaldehyde and antifreeze and glyphosates in there and mercury and all this stuff in these vaccines? Why do they put them in there? And the reason they do is not because they're mean or unaware. It's because if you don't put, say, aluminum in most of the vaccines, you don't make antibodies. So you have to put it in there. You have to do something that essentially irritates, or you could even say poisons, the immune system or stimulates. Technically speaking, we're talking about antibody activation. Now, so the point of the vaccine program is to repeatedly create an immune activation specifically of the humoral antibody immune system. Now, if you say all those diseases, asthma, allergies, peanut allergies, Crohn's, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, nephrotic syndrome, you name it, what do they all have in common? They are all immune activation, excessive antibody production. There's no surprise there. I mean, that's how we diagnose rheumatoid arthritis, is we look for elevated antibodies in the blood. That's how we diagnose peanut allergies. We look for elevated peanut antibodies in the blood. So to say that there aren't elevated antibodies, of course, is ridiculous. That's the actual definition of the disease. So the question then becomes, why do we have 140 or so million people in the United States with too many antibodies? I would submit that even though it's not the only cause, but the point of the vaccine program was to stimulate people to have too many antibodies. So, I mean, it's a funny thing to say, but it worked.
Yeah, you get what you pay for.
Yeah,
basically.
I don't know what anybody would expect.
Yeah.
Now, I just want to point out that I'm not the first person to say this, by no means. There's literally hundreds of papers, including by a guy named Yehuda Schoenfeld, who's the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Autoimmunology and the editor of Autoimmunity Reviews. He's an Israeli guy. And he says there's 150 million people worldwide who have elevated antibodies, autoimmune disease, based on adjuvants and vaccines. It's actually called the Asia syndrome, autoimmune syndrome induced by adjuvants. It's actually going to now be renamed the Schoenfeld syndrome, because he was the first one to identify it, but to characterize it as such a widespread phenomena. So he says at least 150 million people, and that it can happen even 40 years later.
Wow.
Because the problem is, if you give somebody aluminum, which is a very potent immune activator of the humoral immune system, everybody knows that it doesn't just make you make antibodies to diphtheria toxin. We don't have any adjuvant that knows how to do that. It just makes you make antibodies. So if you have peanut protein in the vaccine, if you're eating peanuts, if your thyroid is inflamed, and so you have thyroid antigens around, if there's, you know, foreign DNA, which is in the vaccines, if there's other viruses, which we don't know about, in the vaccines, which there are, then any of those are fair game for your body to make antibodies. I mean, basically, you just told it to make antibodies. You didn't tell it to make antibodies to diphtheria toxin. I mean, we don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
So it does. I mean, you know, I don't know what anybody would expect.
Right. It's blindingly obvious, really. And I just want to summarize for the listeners, because we just went kind of deep into some immunology, but basically just think of this as two different immune systems almost. It's cell-mediated. Your first reaction when you first get exposed to one of these bugs or germs, your white blood cells come in there with lots of chemical weapons to kill that and get rid of it. And as Dr. Cowan said, that's what creates all the symptoms, fever and mucus and cough and sweat and temperature and diarrhea and being sick. So that's the cell-mediated response, the sick. And then the memory, your body has memory and it makes these antibodies, so it will remember that virus for later on when you get exposed to it the rest of your life. You'll quickly recognize it and kill it without ever even knowing. So that's the second immune system, your humoral or antibody immune system. And that's one you won't really feel. You won't know. It's in the background just doing its job. It's clearing out these bugs every time you breathe one in. But it's essential to have that first response, that cell-mediated response, that first line of defense has to happen for the whole system to work right. And so basically what we're describing here, Dr. Cowan's describing, is a bypassing of that first responder and going straight to the memory immune system, trying to give you a permanent memory. It turns out it just doesn't work. And I think that one of the quotes in the book, you said, modern pediatrics is an assault on the cell-mediated immune response and an overstimulation of the humoral response, which is the antibody response. So if you think about this, pediatricians and doctors and parents, I mean, we don't want to see our kids suffering, so we first sign a fever, we go to the Tylenol and ibuprofen, and we alternate every 2 hours to keep that fever down. If they have mucus or a cough, we give them some a cough suppressant and some mucolytic, some drugs to basically suppress the runny, snotty nose and the cough and the fever and the aches and the pains and the diarrhea. And we go to the doctor to, if the over-the-counter stuff doesn't work, we go to the doctor and he'll give you something to try to suppress all that too. So that's the assault. That is pediatrics in a nutshell. It's we're trying to suppress the first responders, the cell-mediated response. And at the very same time, we're giving all the vaccinations, telling the body to make these antibodies, to make these memory cells. So it's just this perfect storm of, really, I think of it as a teeter-totter. We're pushing one end down, and the other end's getting overstimulated. So, as Dr. Cowan has said, what do you expect? You know, follow this out for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. What do you expect but a population that's full of too many antibodies, an immune system that's out of balance, and it's making way too many antibodies to all sorts of stuff, including your thyroid, your gut, your joints, your skin, your lungs, your brain. It's kind of this obvious conclusion. So from what you said, Dr. Cowan, it would make me think, well, maybe there's a way to get adjuvants that are not so stimulated or not so bad, but then the whole vaccine doesn't work. Basically, you've got to scrap the whole theory and the engineering of it all and go back to the drawing board. But I think what a good engineer would conclude is, wow, the original system was the best. We need to get back to it.
Exactly. I mean, the irony of this whole system and our whole approach, and I went through this with measles, is if you get even more into it. So here, you know, so number one, you know, did measles work to eradicate death from measles? So that's an important question. Now, people say, well, there's no science about this. I can tell you the exact reference where I'm getting this from, which was it's a journal article written by a guy named Prausch et al. It was 2007, published in JAMA. So JAMA is one of the most respected medical journals in the United States, and Prausch is a senior scientist at the CDC. So this is as conventional vaccine research as there is. And as far as I know, it's the most cited vaccine article ever written. In other words, almost every article on vaccine says, well, we're getting part of this from Prausch et al. So he looked at the death rate from all these vaccinatable diseases in the 20th century up until, you know, the year 2000. And he says in there that, just take one example, that the death rate from measles dropped by 98% as a result of the vaccine. So you read that, and that's what they cite. And you think, well, that's pretty impressive. And if that's all you know about it, you would be pretty impressed. But let's just talk about the details a little bit. And so I'm going to just simplify the numbers so people can understand, if that's okay. So if you take a look at the actual data, 1910, there was approximately 100 deaths of measles per 100,000 children. And then in 1953, there was approximately 4 deaths per 100,000 children. Now, the measles vaccine was introduced in 1963, so that's 10 years later. From 53 to 63, the death rate slowly crept down from 4 to about 2, and then after the 63, it continued to creep down to about 0.2 per 100,000. So, in other words, 100 per 100,000 in 1910, 4 per 100,000 in 1953. 10 years later, the vaccine got introduced, and it went down to 0.2. So you could say, how did he come up with a 98% decline because of vaccines. Because if you look at it, 98% of the decline was before vaccines were introduced.
Right. Yep.
So how did he get that? Well, it's very simple. He used only the 7 years before the vaccine was introduced as his starting point.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it went from 4 per 100,000 to 0.2 per 100,000. And so that's a 99% decline or so. Numbers are not quite right.
Yep.
And so that's what he said. Well, he turns out he's accurate because it, if you do start from 7 years before 63, it is a 99% decline. However, it went from 4 to 0.2. The real decline was from 100 to 4, and that was before the vaccine. And he ignored that you know, 60 years,
yeah,
because then he would have to say the decline from the vaccines was approximately 0.3%, and we don't even know if it had anything to do with the vaccine.
Yeah, yeah, it was already on the downward trend.
It was done. Why didn't we celebrate? Now, here's the problem. So in 1953, and up for the next 10 years, essentially nobody died from measles. Or it was very rare. And all the children got it between the ages of 3 and 7. The mothers, the women, were immune for life, so that when they had babies, they passed antibodies through their breast milk, and so the babies for the first year and a half were protected by so-called passive immunity, which means the babies got antibodies until it became safe for them to get measles starting around 1.5 to 2. And then they would get measles and they were immune for life. The problem is people die from measles at two times in their life. One is in the first 6 months, and second when they're old people. So then when they introduced the vaccines, which now the vaccine lasts, the primary one, you make antibodies maybe 7 to 10 years, and each booster maybe 3 to 5 years. And how do I know that? Because that's why they give you boosters, because the immunity wears off, the antibodies. So we've created a situation now where none of the mothers have antibodies to pass to their children.
Yeah.
And none of the old people are immune because their antibody production has worn off. So they've created a situation where measles was already, we had herd immunity, if you want to use that ridiculous term. We had herd immunity before the vaccines. The problem is the vaccine program ruined herd immunity, or protection of the population against measles, because you can never get lifelong immunity from a vaccine. And so now we have a situation where all of the people over 40 are not immune to measles, and none of the babies are. Exactly the worst possible situation. And that's just so, first of all, it's very clear that that's the case. That's why they're starting to immunize, to vaccinate adults every 5 years for measles, because they know they're not immune anymore. God knows what's going to happen to adults when you inject them with a live viral vaccine of measles. I mean, we have no idea. We've never done that before. It's just such an unspeakable mistake,
yeah,
you know, in strategic mistake to have done that. And I'm not sure the way out now.
Well, I'm not either. And unfortunately, we need to talk about another bad mistake we made when it comes to chickenpox and shingles. So we'll get into that after the break. But we're up against the break right now, so we'll take a quick commercial break, and we will be right back. Stick with us. We've got to talk about this chickenpox thing, because I can relate to this. I'm 44 now, but I had chickenpox growing up, no big deal. Kind of like my older patients I talk to now, we go back and get a childhood illness history on them, and all the old folks say, yeah, I had measles, had Mumps had they'll say the usual childhood illnesses. But one of those, now that I can say I had, was chicken pox. It's no big deal. It's pretty itchy for a week and a little fever, and you got to stay home and get mothered or fathered. Your parents took good care of you, and I got to sleep in my parents' bed and watch TV, is what I remember, and drink a Coca-Cola for some reason.
Yeah.
But anyways, they took care of me. Now, and so I want to go to this quote, because we need to talk about what this chicken pox vaccine has done to us. But at the end of chapter 8 in your book, you say, the question this leaves me with is, did those who develop and aggressively lobbied for the introduction of the chickenpox vaccine know that a mass vaccination against chickenpox would result in an epidemic of shingles? If they did and anticipated that, it would also open up a market for a shingles vaccine, then that's unspeakable. If, on the other hand, the shingles outbreak that is a consequence nobody predicted or took seriously, that's almost worse, because it suggests that the experts and the institutions we're supposed to trust either don't understand what the risks are or what the consequences of vaccination may ultimately be. Or they downplay those risks and consequences so significantly that they move forward with questionable vaccination program regardless. So let's talk about that a little bit. A pretty benign chickenpox viral illness that we all had, and no big deal, and then we have lifelong immunity. Speak to that a little bit, if you will, and what this vaccine program has caused in a way of a shingles epidemic, which, by the way, the patient I just saw before I came to the radio just now, she's 38 years old, had a horrible shingles outbreak last year when she was 37, and I see this all the time in these young folks, 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, severe shingles outbreaks, which we used to never see. It was always in really old folks. But can you speak to that a little bit, Dr. Cowan?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm a little bit older than you, and I remember, you know, my mother taking me to this the Menenberg's house when they had measles, so I would get it, and I think it was because it was the summer, and she thought, well, at least he won't miss school, because, you know. So nobody thought much about it then. They just wanted to get it over with at a convenient time. Chickenpox, you know, it's a... another different kind of virus, and you get it, and like you say, you get sick for about a week. Usually the cell-mediated reaction goes for about a week, and then you get over it, and you're immune for life. Now, and they were trying to figure out some way. They developed a chickenpox vaccine, the same kind of thing, where they basically stimulate the humoral system and not have the cell-mediated reaction be part of it, or only a minor part. And they were trying to develop a rationale for it, because the mortality and morbidity from chickenpox was so low that there was no, you know, good medical explanation for why they should even do this. So the best rationale was one study that showed that the earning power of the mothers was slightly increased if their children did not get chickenpox, because they usually would have to miss 3 to 5 days of work, and that translated into whatever, thousands of dollars. And so if you give them chickenpox vaccine, your family income for the year would increase by a few thousand dollars. So that became the main rationale. But along the way, and it's very clear from documentation that I've seen with emails and different studies that were published, that one of the reasons, so when you get chickenpox, you can get it does lay dormant in your nerves, and at some point in your life, you can get a recurrence along a certain nerve root, and we call that shingles. And it used to be a fairly rare occurrence, found only in elderly people who were having trouble, usually from some other reason. And what they discovered was that having adults throughout their life being continually exposed to chickenpox in children, so in other words, let's say you're a grandparent and your grandchild got chickenpox, you would essentially be given a booster of the chickenpox virus, and that would help prevent you from getting shingles. So just having chickenpox in the population essentially prevented the older people from getting this sort of secondary complication of chickenpox called shingles. So shingles is not very much fun. Everybody knows that. It doesn't really kill anybody, but it's certainly unpleasant and can go on for 6 months. And unpleasant is an understatement.
Yeah, my patient today would have laughed at that. Yeah, she said right. It was horrible. I mean, the pain is...
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Yep.
So they then developed a vaccine against shingles, but since shingles was such a low incidence in the population, they concluded that there was no market for it because people weren't worried about shingles. So they had to figure out a way to make shingles more prevalent in the population. And so the way to do that was to discovered that if you got rid of chickenpox in the children, you would stop the adults from getting this rebooster, this re-exposure to the chickenpox virus throughout their life, and that would make the adults more and more susceptible to shingles at earlier and earlier ages, which would then increase the demand for the shingles vaccine. And so that's exactly what they did. They had no other rationale besides this saving people a few bucks for doing the chickenpox, but they realized it would create a virtual epidemic of shingles, and then 15 years later they could introduce the shingles vaccine and people would say, thank God, now we can do something about shingles. Well, it turns out that you can get shingles from the shingles vaccine. It's not particularly effective anyways, and like all of them, it creates a whole imbalance in the working of your immune system and all kinds of other complications. So it really wasn't a very good trade. We were a lot better off with children getting chickenpox, adults getting continually exposed throughout their life, rarely getting shingles. Neither one was much of a problem, and now we have a problem with both.
Yeah, well, and that's not even getting into, which could be a whole nother radio show, the benefits of chickenpox. You quoted a study from Baylor College of Medicine, a 21% reduction in developing a glioma, which is a type of brain cancer, in those who had been exposed to chickenpox or had chickenpox as a child. But even throughout the book, besides shingle or chickenpox, measles, if you'd gotten measles naturally, you decrease your risk of various illnesses like heart disease and arthritis and allergies. So there's some beneficial mechanisms going on. When you acquire these germs naturally, you have a natural cell-mediated response at first responder, and then also your memory cells stick around. Somehow that keeps your immune system trained up to help you fight off these chronic diseases later down the road.
Absolutely. Give me a medicine to produce a fever, and I can not only cure any disease, but I can prevent most of them.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And there isn't a single chronic disease. There isn't a single disease that is common amongst older Americans that there isn't a peer-reviewed study showing some childhood illness, whether it's mumps, measles, chickenpox, whatever. It doesn't have a significant prevention of people getting that whatever it is, chronic disease later in life.
Yeah.
Not a single one.
Just an incredible system.
Yeah, that has to be taken into account as a negative consequence of the mass prevention of chickenpox. As you said, we know that you are now more susceptible to brain cancer, certain particularly unpleasant form of it. And again, unpleasant is a vast understatement.
There. Yeah. Well, and we've only got about 4 minutes left or so, and there's so much more I want to ask you about, but I do want to just, for the audience's sake, I want to point out a couple highlights from the book. You quoted a Japanese study, I think Kobe University, 2009 maybe, but basically it showed that in lab animals, they gave them the routine vaccination schedule, and they gave a group they did not give the vaccine schedule to, and there's increased autoimmunity, plain and simple. I mean, the numbers were just clear. You do the routine vaccine schedule, you get more autoimmune, and in the group you didn't, you don't. So there's lots of evidence starting to mount. From whichever angle you try to slice or dice this, it really brings into question the schedule. And we don't have time to get into polio, unfortunately. We really will have to have you back. But I do want to point out that there's a lot of questions about the polio vaccine, too. And two main points you brought out that caught my attention were half the people that with paralytic polio symptoms, they could not find the virus in them. There was no evidence they actually had the quote-unquote polio virus in them. And also, you point out the polio virus, the virus that everyone labeled as the culprit for causing paralytic polio, it's been around for ages and ages as part of our normal gut flora. I mean, it's been sitting in our bacterial makeup in our gut for 1,000 years. So there's more to the story with polio, and you make a very good case for DDT, the insecticide they sprayed to kill mosquitoes. I think you talk about running behind the truck that sprayed the DDT when you were a kid, but
yeah, right.
How that particular toxin attacks the anterior horn of the spinal cord, just like we see in this virus that we've blamed polio for. So that's a whole other fascinating topic too. And really, the part I really want to get to, we didn't have time, was the intracellular water, the structured water inside the cell, and how that gives the cell energy to do what it needs to do, and how a lot of these adjuvants disrupt that, or toxins in general, from mercury to aluminum to glyphosate, will disturb the structural integrity of that fourth phase of water, which our listeners know about. We've talked about with Dr. Pollack before and others here. But that intracellular water, but the ATP and the energy production, all that was fascinating part of the book. So really enjoyed that. And again, I'm sorry we're kind of rushing here at the end, but that the hour's about up. So I'll give you the last couple minutes if you have any wisdom for us or any final point or part that we didn't get to talk about that you really wanted to drive home.
Yeah, I appreciate that, you know, how thorough you actually read the book, and because a lot of it was about water and actually the mechanism of how the cell-mediated detoxification works. And so that was I felt like that was sort of my big contribution.
Right. I mean, it reminded me of your book on the heart and how just such a new way to think about that. It was really incredible.
Yeah, and maybe I close with a quote. This is even for me, because I say even me because I've been in this for so long. But I must admit that when I read this, it was just, you just shake your head. And this is a quote by a guy you may have heard of called Albert Sabin. You know him?
Oh, yeah. I've heard of him.
He's the guy who developed the Sabin polio vaccine.
Right.
He is considered one of the fathers of vaccine science and vaccine, you know, production. He's like Bill Gates in computers or Steve Jobs.
Right.
So he said, quote, official data have shown that large-scale vaccination in the U.S. has failed to obtain any significant improvement of the diseases for which they are supposed to provide immunization. In essence, it was and is a failure.
Wow.
Which is like Bill Gates saying, you know, these computers, I don't think that was a good idea.
Yeah, never mind. Let's rewind.
Never mind. Never mind. That was... It's not so good for people.
All right. Well, that's a great quote, and I think we have 30 seconds, so I'm going to end it on a quote. I'm not trying to one-up you, but this is from the introduction of your book, and it blew me away when I read this quote. And you were quoting Rudolf Steiner from 1917. He gave a series of 14 lectures in Switzerland, and in one of these lectures he remarked, "There will come a time when people will say, it is pathological for people to even think in terms of spirit and soul. Quote, sound people will speak of nothing but the body. it will be considered a sign of illness for anyone to arrive at the idea of any such thing as a spirit or a soul. People who think like that will be considered to be sick. And you can be quite sure of it, a medicine will be found for this. Taking a, quote, sound point of view, people will invent a vaccine to influence the organism as early as possible, preferably as soon as it is born, so that this human body never even gets the idea that there is a soul and a spirit. Materialistic physicians will be asked to drive the souls out of humanity. That was powerful. So...
yeah.
We'll end it on that. Dr. Cowan, right. Thank you very much for joining us today. Fascinating book. I recommend everyone get Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness by Dr. Thomas Cowan. And we'd love to have you back someday, Dr. Cowan.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.